AM.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now, here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. I'm Dr. Richard Schertz.
And I'm Jim Russ.
And I've had a lot of fun with technology this week. We've been checking out some of the security issues. There's been some hacking of hand scanners with malware. We've got some hacks that are on the Tor, proxy server system. So I'm going to talk about surfing the web anonymously and what sort of activities are going there and talk about some of the security issues on the Internet. We're also going to talk about how we are going to use the Raspberry Pi to teach programming to the children in Syria. And, of course, it was a huge, huge mailbag.
Giant.
There's a letter in your mailbox.
Oh, yeah. Here we go.
It bounced.
That's right. We got a letter led by Brain. Dear Dr. Schertz, in early 2013, I bought my first Mac. I'd been a PC user for decades. Despite the initial learning curve, I'm a really happy camper. And I came across this article, and I wish you commented on the how and why Apple's revolution and how it is somehow interwoven with the computer industry. I remain a glad Mac user, despite the fact that this article is griping about the fact that Apple products are a little harder to use over the years. On another note, Google stuff seems to be getting me quite upset. I see this error message when I tried to use Google Maps, and it said my internet connection was down, but actually their server was down because my internet connection was up. And I had a Google voice number, then I canceled it because of telemarketing calls. And then when I try to get it back again, I can't find it. You know, I need your help on this. Mm-hmm. P.S. I hate it when you go on vacation. Despite the fact that you've earned it. Well, thank you, led by Brain. Well, Apple products are, in fact, becoming more complex as they add features. Now, Apple, and that article contends that Apple is losing its legendary simplicity. And actually, Apple is able to make superb devices. And they're basically a device company, and they basically have set up a very good device ecosystem. But people have said when they started getting all this iCloud stuff and interconnection stuff that it's become just more complicated. I mean, case in note, the iPhoto. People have trouble managing the memory on their iPhotos, and they, you know, because you run out of space. You can't put your iPhotos in subdirectories. You can't manage the memory. It actually, and then you've got to plug it in and copy it to your hard drive, and then iTunes shows up, and so it's pretty hard to do. And then, and even with iTunes, you know, in the old days, you just would take your CDs and just rip MP3s, and now iTunes wants to take your MP3s, and then you can't transfer it to another computer. They try to put digital rights management on your own music,
mm-hmm.
And so all of the cloud stuff has actually added layers of complexity. And what they're contending is that it made the Apple products more difficult to use. This always happens as you add more and more features. It just becomes more complex. But Apple still, I think, does focus on simplicity. And one thing that they do is they've got these users, and they have extensive usability tests where they'll come up with a product, then they'll put users in a room with a one-way mirror, and they just watch what they do. And so the developers think it's perfectly intuitive how it operates, but they just watch users with no experience look at it, and based on actual user experiences, they modify the system. And that sort of human engineering is one of the hallmarks that Apple's had. So I think it's really quite good. As far as your second comment about Google Voice. Now, you had a phone number. You canceled it, and they won't give it back to you. Now, one thing, Google is not necessarily going to keep your phone number because they have to pay for these phone numbers.
Mm-hmm.
So these phone numbers cost the money, and they have a certain limited number of phone numbers in each region. Now, if they haven't reallocated your phone number, you may be able to get it back, but you've got to go to the Google Voice recovery page, and that would be let me go back here to check this thing out. Oh yeah, this is google.com/voice/account/recovery.
The Google website has gotten very complicated, hasn't it?
That's right.
So it's
google.com/voice/account/recovery, and then you put in your old Google Voice number, and if they still have it, it will come up. So that's what I would do, but they may have reallocated it to someone, and then you just have to get another number. Mm-hmm. I mean, that would be one thing that you have. But that was an excellent email, and we certainly enjoy that you are a long-term listener.
Yes.
Now we got another email from Alice in Reston. Alice had a problem with managing her pictures. And so this is Alice has on her iPhone, she said she's got a 16 gigabyte iPhone and she's run out of space. And now she's got to manage these pictures. And this is sort of gets at the same thing that we were talking about at Led by Brain. So how does she do that? Well, you actually have got to remove the pictures from your camera if you want to manage them. So you've got to take the cable and plug it into the USB port of your computer, and then it looks like an external hard drive. So then you can basically go to My Computer, click on that, go to the external hard drive of the iPhone, and you can tap on that, and you can get the list of pictures. You can just copy those pictures to your PC. Now, if you copy them to your PC, you also want to back them up because these are you need them in two places. So what I do, I've got an external hard drive. I copy all the pictures to the external hard drive. Plus, I keep them on my laptop.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, I back up to Carbonite. So I actually have all my pictures three places, except that one hard drive that I discovered, it was only in one place. But but now it's in three places. Now I've got everything taken care of. Now, as soon as you copy them off of your iPhone, what I recommend is you sort them by date and put them into folders that have something to do with the events.
Sure.
If you just have a wad of like 1,000 pictures.
Exactly.
It is just a pain in the neck. So organize them now into folders on your computer. Now, what I do to further make my pictures more usable on my laptop, I've installed Picasa. I love Picasa. I had it before Google bought it. And what Picasa does, it searches your entire hard drive and it organizes all your pictures and albums, and you can then review them in chronological order. You can actually view them because there's actually GPS data on your pictures. You can actually look at pictures from a particular region. It also has face recognition. You could actually look at every picture that Johnny is in because it would be face recognition. And so it's a very good way to manage your photos. And then as soon as you get your photos taken off your iPhone, you've got them backed up two places, I just delete them right from the computer. I just highlight the whole – you can't delete the folder because that's managed by the system, but I just highlight all the pictures from my laptop and I just delete them all. Otherwise, you have to go individually to every single picture on your iPhone and delete it. So that block deletion is very good. This picture management is becoming a huge problem because people now take all kinds of pictures. The final suggestion I have is that most people take a lot of really bad pictures.
Sure.
So there might be at an event and there could be like four pictures that are really good and there could be 10 pictures that are just garbage. While you're taking and putting the pictures in the folder, look at them full screen, and delete the bad ones.
Sure,
instead
exactly.
of saving them, just get rid of all the bad ones.
That's the first part of management, is just weeding it
first
out,
First part
right?
of management. Now, actually, what I do whenever I well, like if I'm on vacation and I'm running out of space, I don't have any place to put my photos, I'll go through my iPhone and I'll just delete all the bad pictures right in the iPhone in order to clear up more space. And then what I do, I've got to reboot the iPhone so it knows there's more space available. Mm-hmm. And so I do that. But that was a good question. And that is getting to be a bigger and bigger issue, this photo management.
You know, it used to be when we all just had cameras, you kind of were very, very selective because you were burning up film every time you took
yeah.
a camera. Now you just snap away at will, right?
And so, and the other thing, I always used to get prints. You know, I would get a roll of film developed and get prints.
When was the last time you actually picked up a picture and looked at it?
No, it's been a while. Now, what I did do, I actually went through, I haven't done this for a couple of years. I went through and I created what I called a print subdirectory, pictures that I thought were suitable for printing. And I would just put them into my, and I'd copy them. So I'd actually have them stored two places. And then in my print subdirectory, I'd have all the pictures that I thought I would print. And then I just got an account with Costco, actually. I logged on to Costco. And I just upload the pictures to Costco, and I go and pick them up the next day.
Yeah,
but I haven't really done that for 2 years. But your comment just reminded me. Actually, I do like to have pictures to show people.
Yeah,
and it's just a pain to have to open up the computer and do this whole deal. Although now with the Chromecast, I can put my pictures. I can project. I can look at my pictures on the TV if I want. But still, it's a pain in the neck.
Yep.
Well, listen, we love that email, Alice. And remember, just email us at techtalk@stratford.edu.
It's Saturday morning, and this is Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM, HD2. Stand by. We will have more of Tech Talk right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment. Change your life. Put your talents out there on your terms. Get full credit for your ideas and hard work, and set your own pay. If you're ready to be your own CEO, Stratford University's life-changing Masters in Entrepreneurial Management program can show you how to develop and launch your business. From writing a solid business plan to financing, legal issues, staffing, even branding and marketing. Let Stratford show you the ropes and walk you over the pitfalls of running your own business. Choose from online or in-classroom courses at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Change your life. Take charge of your future on your own terms. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. That's 800-444-0804. Stratford University. Changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. And now it is time for
Profiles in IT.
Yes, today we're talking about Anthony M. Fidel. He is the father of the iPod.
But wait a minute. Didn't we talk about the true father of the iPod last week?
No, we talked about the man who rejected the iPod at Real Networks.
Right.
Everybody thought it was Steve Jobs who was father of the iPod. No, he's the front man. This is actually the guy who was father of the iPod. And while he worked at Apple, Steve Jobs would not let anybody talk about him. He could not talk to the public. He was kept in the bowels of the company
wow.
so that other companies would not steal him.
Ah.
And it wasn't until he quit Apple that all the information came out. Now he actually has a Facebook page, Tony Fidel, father of the iPod. Anthony M. Fidel was born in Detroit, Michigan, in 1969. His family moved all over the country. He attended actually 11 schools while he was growing up. When he was 8 years old, he had his first job selling eggs. He finally settled down enough to graduate from high school in Grosse Pointe South High School in Grosse Pointe Farms, Michigan. He received a Bachelor in Science and Computer Engineering from the University of Michigan in 1991, and that's when he started his first company, Constructive Instruments, which marketed multimedia composition software for children. This is software where kids could, like, make little movies and things, multimedia, make little, you know, sort of digital multimedia displays. And that company's now defunct, but that was his first attempt at a company. Ultimately, he actually started six companies throughout his career, as well as working for other large companies. In 1992, he started working for an Apple spinoff called General Magic.
Mm-hmm.
And he started out as a diagnostics engineer. He progressed to a systems architect for the MagicCat PDA platform. This was quite a successful PDA operating system that used this, where you'd sort of, if you'd want to say do print a file, print a document, you might go to the printer room. It had a metaphor of rooms. If you wanted to look up a file, you might go to the file storage room. And so you walk throughout the thing. It was sort of, you know, hokey at that time, but it was very popular. Now, during his 3.5 years at MagicCap, he worked almost continuously. He lost touch with his family. All of his personal relationships got messed up. He gained 40 pounds. And then finally, he lost 40 pounds. So he just was really so taken with making this product go that he just sort of lost all perspective.
Let himself go.
He let himself go. In 1995, he was hired by Philips, and he co-founded the Mobile Computing Group. He served as chief technology officer and director of engineering. Now, in order to work for a big company, because this guy is sort of a startup kind of guy, he demanded that his group looked just like a startup. So he got his own building. He painted the walls purple and yellow. There were open cubicles, free soda and fruit. And nobody was required to take the mandatory drug test.
Oh, boy. Party time.
And so when he had the opening party for his group, he served as DJ there for the group. So he is quite the social bug, and he likes this startup energy. This is what he is. He's very driven. He likes the startup energy. He actually calls himself a studied engineer or a self-proclaimed designer. He has a passion for designing portable devices. He feels that when you've got very limited space, it forces you to be more creative. So this is what he loves to do. He made small portable devices at in the Mobile Computing Group for Philips. He's always focused on these small portable devices. So he decided to start his own company called Fuse in 1990. This might have been the second or third company that he did. Now, this one, his vision, he wanted to become the Dell of consumer electronics. You know, we had the Dell of PCs. He wanted to become the Dell of consumer electronics, where he could, you know, basically market over the Internet. But the one device that he had in mind was this small hard disk music player. He said, you know, that might be a very good product line, so people could carry music around in their pocket. Well, Fuse failed to get the second round of funding. So he's running out of money, started exploring his options. So his first place, he said, you know, I'm going to go to the company that controls 85% of all the music being distributed on the Internet, Real Networks, and see if they'd like a music player. It looks like it'd be a perfect match to their product line. Okay, it turns out that Tony Fadell is a screamer. He talks very loud. He's, like, very emotional.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that the owner of Real Networks has the same personality. So the guy hired him. But after only 6 months, 6 weeks of, like, conflict,
banging heads,
shouting matches, he left. It wasn't a good match. And I think Real Networks lost the iPod opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
So he went to Apple, was his second choice. Now, Apple was an innovative company, but they didn't really have any music. They were making Macs. And they had just launched earlier that year the iTunes, which was just a way to rip music off of CDs and store them as an MP3. There was no iTunes store. It was just a way to rip music off of a CD. And so they just released iTunes around January of 2001. And he went to Apple, told Steve Jobs about his idea, and Steve said, okay, that sounds pretty good. So he was out on the ski slopes there in Colorado, and he got a phone call from Apple. They said, Tony, have we got a deal for you? So he flew back, talked to Apple, and they said, okay, this player looks like this could be an interesting product, but we're not really sure whether we want to go with it. We're just going to hire you as a contractor. We don't want to actually give you a full-time job yet.
Uh-huh.
So they hired him as a contractor in February of 2001, and he started developing the iPod. And he wanted a small device, and he was working on that. Around April of 2001, Steve Jobs said, looks like this is going somewhere. Let's lock this guy up. So they hired him full time in April of 2001 to assemble and run the iPod and Special Projects Group. So he's actually the guy that started iPod at Apple from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
He pulled together a team of 35 engineers. He oversaw the design and production of the iPod. He was also in charge of what they called the iSight device, which was their first webcam. I'd forgotten that.
Know they had
their first webcam was iSight.
Huh.
So it's
a good name.
Yeah, it's a good name then. I don't think they use it anymore. It turned out there was a company called Portal Player. I keep wanting to say Porta Party.
I understand.
Portal Player.
Yeah, I'm trying to raise the bar over here.
Well, thank you. At least one of us is. So they'd been working on a prototype music device that was about the size of a pack of cigarettes. Not nearly as elegant as the iPod that Tony had designed, but they had developed very nice software interface. So he partnered with Portal Player on the software design for the new Apple Player. So in 8 months, Tony's team and Portal Player completed the prototype software and hardware, and it had the polished user interface with the famous scroll bar in the middle. So in October 23rd of 2001, Apple announced the iPod, which had been created under the project code name Dulcimer.
Ooh.
Okay, so all during 2001, Tony worked on Dulcimer, okay, not on the iPod.
Mm-hmm.
The iPod was formally released November 10th, 2001. So look at this. He went to Apple in February of 2001 as a contractor. November 10th of 2001, the product was released. That is a quick
cycle time. Well, and they recognized early on that this was something that would go someplace. And that's
right.
part of the thing has been aware of the next trend.
Being able to recognize it.
Yes,
but moreover,
right.
Steve Jobs was able to create an environment for Tony that he liked. They gave
lots of soda, fruit, and drugs.
Yeah. I don't know about the drugs.
Okay,
but,
sorry.
But he had his own group, and he could run it any way he wanted. I mean, he was and so he actually was quite happy there. Now, Tony Fadell was kept out of the picture, even though he developed the device from the very beginning. He headed the team of 35 designers. Jobs really always wanted to be the face of the iPod. He was afraid that the competition would steal his best engineers, and that's why no one could interview Tony Fadell, and nobody could interview him. There was no information on him. He was like totally devoid from any Apple literature.
The man behind the Iron Curtain.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and so it was just, they did not want anybody to know about it. Because, you see, Steve Jobs learned earlier, just before when he was coming out with the Mac, he had a big press conference, and he gave these interviews about how they were going to take over the PC world with this Mac, and he got these great team of engineers coming up with these new ideas. And he highlighted his engineers. Within the next month, most of his engineers had been stolen by the competition because they offered twice the salary.
Right.
So Steve said, that's never going to happen again. And he feels as though the fact he lost all those engineers is why he never dominated the Mac market. So he was always paranoid about people stealing his folks. He was promoted to vice president of the iPod Engineering Group in 2004. And in March of 2006, he was promoted to senior vice president of the iPod division. Now, get this. As of April 2007, the iPod had sold over 100 million units worldwide. In this device, many feel, almost single-handedly turned Apple around.
Wow.
Because before that, it was just the Mac. And now, most of their revenue stream is the iPod was the beginning, and that led to the iPhone. It's a whole series of devices because the I mean, if you add a phone, a phone radio to an iPod, you have an iPhone. So an iPhone's really just an iPod that you can make phone calls with. So this began a whole direction for Apple that really turned it around. November 4th, 2008, he stepped down as senior vice president, but he's still remaining as an advisor to Steve Jobs, CEO. So now Tony's got his own Facebook page. You can just go Facebook, tony.fidel.ipod.inventor.
Uh-huh.
Not, I guess he wants everybody to know now that he was the iPod inventor.
Now there's no risk.
There's no risk. He doesn't work for Apple anymore, and so he's quite the man. And he loves to design small devices. He's an interesting guy and the man behind the scenes on the iPod.
Sounds very interesting. Do you have an iPod?
We have an iPod at home. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Marianne won an iPod.
Of course. She's won both
two iPads
and the iPod.
And an iPod, yeah. So we do have an iPod. Yes, we do. Everything has been won, though.
That's truly amazing.
So I can say honestly, I've never purchased an Apple product.
That's funny. I'm still conflicted. I've told you I'm looking for a new phone. I can't decide iPhone or BlackBerry. I just the whole thing that you can't change a battery in an iPhone really bugs me.
Yeah, that is the disadvantage.
You can do that with a BlackBerry, right? You get a new battery.
You can do it with the BlackBerry. So you just have to be prepared to recharge your phone at lunch if you want an iPhone.
But, I mean, when the battery – because I keep a phone for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
When the battery finally gives up the ghost for good in the iPhone, then I've got to get another phone.
Yeah, you basically – because the battery's welded in and so you soldered in, so you really can't change it. Now, I think you could send it back and get it replaced.
Yeah, but it's going to cost you.
It'll cost you as much as another iPhone probably.
Exactly.
So nobody actually does that. They just get a different one. That battery life is the issue.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, if you – don't use it for anything. If you don't surf the web and don't use any of the features, the battery will last longer. If you turn off Wi-Fi, the Wi-Fi really eats up battery
life.
Yeah,
I wouldn't use the Wi-Fi on it, and I would only surf the web on it to look for emails when I'm out of the office.
Yeah, so if you leave off the Wi-Fi. Now, there's somebody at work that's got an iPhone, and they bought this external battery that plugs into the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
So they carry around this extra battery with them, and they just plug in the bottom, and it gives them about two-thirds of a battery charge. So they have 1 2/3 battery charge, and with that gets them through almost through the day. The problem is when you're on travel, you can't really tether when you're at lunch. And
exactly.
So it's hard to go 8 hours with an iPhone without a recharge.
Yeah, I don't like that
is the problem.
We hope you've been tethered to your radio because your chance to use knowledge and profiles in IT could yield you a very nice prize. By playing the pop quiz coming up here on Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio. Heard every Saturday here at 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM, HD2. Stand by, the pop quiz next here on Tech Talk Radio.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
What's the latest innovation in IT degrees? It's the Stratford University innovative approach that turns marketable skills into an employable edge to get you hired faster in today's hottest fields like cybersecurity, data mining, and mobile networking. At Stratford, our IT instructors bring their own business world experience right into the classroom with real-world problem-solving projects structured like a real business, empowering you with real hands-on skills so you can hit the ground running doing exactly what you learn in the classroom, right in the workplace. It's all part of our proven learn-by-doing approach to IT. Every class, every degree, every day. We offer bachelor's, master's, and associate degree programs at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. Stratford University. Changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
And now,
It's time for Washington's most popular and longest-running radio game show, the Stratford University Pop Quiz. Now here's your host and star of our show. Nope, it's not Monty Hall. It's not Ed McMahon. It's not Dr. Richard Church. It's this guy right here.
And I would be that aforementioned guy right here. My name is Jim Ross. I'm the adjunct professor for lowering academic standards and for causing train wrecks here on Tech Talk on Federal News Radio. We just got finished talking about Anthony Fidel, the guy who invented the Apple iPod. Before Fidel went to work with Apple on the iPod, he actually tried to do this with another company, but butted heads with that company's owner and after 6 weeks left. Tell me the name of the company that Anthony Fidel worked for before Apple to win two tickets for fine dining at the Escoffier Stratford University on the campus in Falls Church or at the campus in Woodbridge at Cafe Karim. But you need to get that answer to me now. Dial these 10 digits in the correct order. If you're calling from west of Detroit, Michigan, it's 877-936-9333. From east of Silicon Valley, it's 877-936-9333. And, of course, for everybody else, the wild card line is 877-936-9333. Andrew Mitchell, our adjunct professor for crowd control and prize distribution, is standing by to take your calls here on the Pop Quiz on Tech Talk Radio.
Hackers infect a hand scanner with malware. A China-based organization is using sophisticated malware, which they install on handheld scanners, to target shipping and logistics organizations from all over the world. The attack is dubbed Zombie Zero. Zombie Zero. And it's been analyzed by cybersecurity solutions provider TrapX. According to TrapX, the attack begins at a Chinese company that provides hardware and software for handheld scanners used by shipping and logistics firms worldwide to manage their inventory. The Chinese manufacturer installs the malware on a Windows XP operating system embedded in the device. Also, the threat is distributed via the company's support website, the security firm noted in its report. The scanners transmit the data they collect, the origin, the destination, the value of the contents, etc., via the customer's wireless network. Once the customer starts using the device, the malware immediately sends this information back to the command and control servers located in China. The command and control servers are located at the Langshang Vocational School, which is an educational institution said to be involved with Operation Aurora attacks against Google. And it's physically located only one block away from the scanner manufacturer. Oh, what a coincidence. The malware used by the Zombie Zero attackers is highly sophisticated. It's polymorphic. That means it changes its look so that you can't use simple pattern matching to pick it up. In one attack, they observed 16 of the 48 scanners used by a victim were infected. Not almost a third of his scanners were infected. The malware had managed to penetrate the targeted organization's defenses, gain access to servers on the corporate network. The company that used the scanners installed security certificates for network authentication, but the certificates are compromised because the malware is already present on the device. Experts determined that the threat group target servers storing corporate financial data, customer data, and other sensitive information. A second payload downloaded by the malwares then establishes a sophisticated look at the company's finance servers, enabling attackers to infiltrate the information, get the information that they're after. Well, this operation appears to be focusing on shipping and logistics companies. The malware is also said to be delivered to organizations in the manufacturing sector. So organizations must take care of where they get their equipment and use reliable equipment vendors and not just the cheapest vendors, or they could be exposed to this attack.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. It is Saturday morning on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM, HD2. We will be back with more right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment. Change your life.
Put your talents out there on your terms. Get full credit for your ideas and hard work, and set your own pay. If you're ready to be your own CEO, Stratford University's life-changing Master's in Entrepreneurial Management program can show you how to develop and launch your business. From writing a solid business plan to financing, legal issues, staffing, even branding and marketing. Let Stratford show you the ropes and walk you over the pitfalls of running your own business. Choose from online or in-classroom courses at our convenient campus locations in Tysons Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Change your life. Take charge of your future on your own terms. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. That's 800-444-0804. Stratford University, changing lives one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. The anonymous operating system called Tails has a zero-day vulnerability, which means it can be hacked. Mm-hmm. Researchers have warned of a critical unpatched flaw in the privacy-focused operating system named Tails, which was made famous by the whistleblower Edward Snowden. This is what he used whenever he went on the internet or whenever he did any messaging or emailing. The zero-day flaws were uncovered by Exodus Intelligence, which finds vulnerabilities. Now, and then they make money on those vulnerabilities. They don't actually go immediately back to the company that's vulnerable. They sell the vulnerability, and they sell it to either side. And then after a certain delay, where their customer has a chance to take advantage of it, they tell the company tell the company that has the flaw. Now, so the customers can use this vulnerability any way they see fit, and it could be used by the government, for instance, to make this operating system so it's not so anonymous after all. Now, the company says it does plan to tell the Tails team about the issues in due time. But they're not rushing to do that. Now, Tails is also known as the Amnesiac Incognito Live System. And you can look it up. You just go to torproject.org. You can kind of look around. Mm-hmm. And what it does, this operating system, it's actually on a thumb drive. You plug it in, you boot off the thumb drive. And first of all, it routes all the traffic through various layers of servers and encrypts the data to ensure privacy. It uses the Tor network of proxy servers, and it forces you to do that. It also has very high-level encryption on all your messaging, your email, and any traffic that you do. Now, the Tor network of servers protects you by bouncing your communication around a distributed network of relays run by volunteers all around the world. Tor is free and open source for Windows, Mac, Linux, and Android. Tails, the Tails OS, is designed to store in a USB stick so users can remove it from their computer and leave no trace. The exploits that Exodus found may undo some of the security promises that Snowden, counted on when he was leaking all the NSA documents. You can download Tor or Tails by going to torproject.org. Now, this Tor actually has been an issue for governments because governments are unable to actually see what people are up to. For instance, it's upset the Russian government in particular. 2 weeks ago, the Russian Interior Minister put out a call to hackers to find ways to identify people who use this anonymous tool, Tor, to browse the internet. Now, Russia's offering 3.9 million rubles to the person who can develop this hack. That's equivalent to about $110,000. It's quite a bit of money. Now, the Russian government's long been looking at Tor, which is this private communications project, which is originally developed, by the way, by the U.S. Naval Research Lab, but it's now independently run. At one point, the head of Russia's Federal Security Services wanted to ban Tor altogether, but they ended that idea. Now they just want to find a way to hack it. Now, Tor uses encryption to obstruct access location and other identifiers, and it allows people to surf the web without being tracked. Tor is used by journalists, activists, and, of course, people conducting illegal activities use it, too. In Russia, it's been an especially useful tool against censorship because it allows you, if you use the Tor network, you can actually bypass all the blocked sites. So if they're trying to block you from going to a site outside of Russia, you can use Tor to circumvent that. And that's how people get around these great firewalls, like the great Chinese firewall that's trying to block people from looking around. Now, only a small number of people in Russia use Tor today, but since May, just the last couple of months, the number of Tor users in Russia has more than doubled to 200,000, according to the Parrot.cc online magazine. So the call to decrypt Tor follows on the heels of recent legislation in Russia that will force popular bloggers to register their sites. Bloggers will not be able to write anything that's considered to be state secret or to promote illegal activities. Bloggers who use Tor are supposed to remain anonymous. Now, even the U.S. National Security Agency, doesn't like Tor. They're working on ways to encrypt Tor because they want to track what people are up to.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Russian ministry is going to reveal the winner of this. Who's going to win the bid to actually hack Tor on August 20th to see who the big winner is of the $111,000 prize. Syrian refugees are going to learn how to code using Raspberry Pi. Now, this is Raspberry Pi. This is a computer. This isn't
not a real Raspberry
this
Pi.
This is not real Raspberry Pi. No, I just want to clarify that.
Okay,
Raspberry Pi has been widely adopted among educators as a cheap way to get computers into the classroom. Now, this summer, young Syrian refugees are going to learn how to code using Raspberry Pi. Now, Raspberry Pi, it's a credit card size computer. It plugs into a TV, so there's no monitor. It's got the output to plug into a TV. It's got the processing power of a PC. It was created by Eben Upton and his colleagues, and the idea was inspired by what they viewed as a lack of university applicant software skills. He was accepting students into the software engineering program in the UK. And see, everybody played around with computers, but nobody actually wrote code. And he remembered that when he was younger, he would always hack the computer, write code. He was always writing stuff, developing stuff. And now everybody's just using it, but they can't develop anything.
Mm-hmm.
So he wanted to get a small, cheap computer that people could actually write code for. And so he basically built the prototype. It was released in 2011 for $35.
Wow.
Now, if you get the keyboard, you get the power supply and all the associated stuff, the kit costs about $100. But the actual computer on the board is only $35. By June of 2014, they had already sold 3 million units. Now, educators see this as a cheap way to get computers in the classroom. It includes multimedia capability. It's got internet capability through Wi-Fi. It's got two built-in programming languages, Python and Scratch. It can play high-definition video. You can have add-ons like a touchscreen LCD or a camera. The device also could be a low-cost publishing platform. Elaine Metney, was sort of fascinated by this. She was a second-year doctoral candidate at University of London's Institute of Education, and she was responsible for setting up a pilot project that sort of led to this whole thing in Syria, or for Syrian refugees. She basically developed a curriculum and launched a pilot project using Raspberry Pi for the Dahour el-Shawi Public Secondary School in Lebanon. And so she'd been developing this, and it was a very successful project. They actually had about 100 Raspberry Pis, and they were teaching kids how to use them, how to use applications on them, how to do some programming for them. Now, James Cranwell Ward, he was an innovation lead in Lebanon for UNICEF. He was impressed with her pilot project, so the two began working together. And they worked for about 6 months on it, and they decided to bring coding and Raspberry Pis to five locations in Lebanon. And these And some of these locations are refugee camps where the Syrian refugees are staying. And they felt that if they could give these young kids a sort of, you know, get them interested in education and give them something where they thought they had a hope for the future other than just poverty and violence, mm-hmm. that it would really, it could really make a difference in the long-term prospects for peace in the area. And Lebanon was a great place for this in the Middle East. For one thing, these camps, these refugee camps, because there's have backup generators because power's on and off all the time. And they also have a lot of TV monitors around. I mean, I had no idea the refugee camps had TVs.
Really?
But they, I guess, you know, so they had a lot of TVs that they could use as monitors mm-hmm. because the Raspberry Pi doesn't have monitors. So a mentee and James Cranwell Ward, they identified a core curriculum in Arabic that had been developed by the Khan Academy. So we featured the guy who started the Khan Academy as a profile on IT. And so they found this material available online at the Khan Academy. They got some Raspberry Pis available for the students. Then using this the Khan Academy curriculum, which is available online, and it's also distributed for free, they developed the program. Now, in addition to using the Raspberry Pis for doing just regular applications like, you know, office applications and other applications and just learn how to use a computer, they're going to teach them the programming language Scratch as well as the programming language Python to build additional programs and games. And the belief is that if you can get kids young enough and you can inspire them enough, you can actually make a difference in sort of their view as to what they can accomplish. I believe this is extremely innovative, and I think we need to go into these troubled areas of the world, and we need to provide education because we can change the course of history education.
We talked about Raspberry Pi on the show a long time ago, was exactly what you were.
That's right.
I mean, it has applications here.
It's got applications here. My, on the way in, I called my the director of the IT program at Stratford. I said, "Are we using Raspberry Pi?" He said, "Yeah, we got them in the classroom." He says, "They're great. The kids are using them. It's our undergraduate software engineering program. They're using it to, you know, programming. We've been doing that for quite a while. These are just great, great tools."
Yeah, it's great for parents to use at home with kids, right?
It is.
Cheap way to get them started.
There you go. Syria's refugees are going to learn how to code with Raspberry Pi in the refugee camps in Lebanon.
And this is Tech Talk Radio. It's Saturday morning. We're on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM, HD2. Stand by. More of Tech Talk right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment. What's the latest innovation in IT degrees? It's the Stratford University innovative approach that turns marketable skills into an employable edge to get you hired faster in today's hottest fields like cybersecurity, data mining, and mobile networking. At Stratford, our IT instructors bring their own business world experience right into the classroom with real-world problem-solving projects structured like a real business, empowering you with real hands-on skills so you can hit the ground running doing exactly what you learn in the classroom, right in the workplace. It's all part of our proven learn-by-doing approach to IT. Every class, every degree, every day. We offer bachelor's, master's, and associate degree programs at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. Stratford University. Changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We're in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology.
And we have a guest.
Yes. Till I walk in.
Hi, folks. This is David Berg.
Don't stop, make it pop. DJ, blow my speakers up tonight. I'm a fighter.
Yeah, there you are.
Can I have a new intro?
No. You don't. Why don't you like that? I went through a lot of time on that.
You're right. Hey, come on. You're right. I'm sorry, man. Forget what I said.
Man, you know how to hurt a guy.
I ran down here as quickly as I could because I heard the dog was talking about the Galaxy elevator.
The space elevator. We did that last week, actually, in our best of show.
See, that keeps that in his back pocket.
That's right.
It's sort of like, you know, the curveball that you need.
Exactly.
It's his strikeout pitch.
Yeah. You never know. You never know when it's going to come
up. He reaches behind his ear, gets a little Brill Cream, put it on the ball.
Little pine tar.
Exactly.
Little pine tar. Doc, I don't have a lot of time here since this is your show.
I'm so sorry to hear that.
Since this is your show. what's the big news you're dropping on everybody today, man? Because normally you have one nugget that I can take with
the
me.
The big news?
The big nugget. Just go to it. I know you like to wait till the end.
Okay.
But give it to us now.
People flying drones are getting arrested.
I was hoping you would. I was hoping you'd talk about drones.
People flying drones are getting arrested. I mean, some guy up in New York City got arrested. Some guy flying a drone down University of Virginia. Just flying his drone, like same kind of drone I have.
Well, let's stop
$10,000 fine.
Stop the show. Has anybody approached you while you've been playing with your drone?
Nobody.
No law enforcement people.
Nobody
said
except
a word.
Except I don't fly it around helicopters.
No. Or near airports.
I do fly over the police
station.
And
you remember the day we did that? The police car drove right past.
He
didn't pay any attention.
Well, he kind of stopped. He looked over. He says, I don't have a rule book for this one. What am I going to do?
There's no check box on the ticket form for
that.
I'm
just going to keep going, and maybe this will go away.
So the other thing is this. You've heard about the big Aereo. They lost their Supreme Court case.
This is a big deal, too. You know all about this, right?
You know, Aereo. They would pull TV off the airways, and then they would stream it over the internet. And so they lost the case saying there's a copyright violation. And I just disagree with this completely. But now what they're trying to do is they're saying, okay, well, if we're then going to be viewed as a cable company, as the Supreme Court said, then there's another rule, the copyright rule, that says that cable companies are allowed to stream on the air TV anyway. So they said we want to be viewed as a, from a copyright point of view, as a cable company, but from a telecom point of view, we want to be viewed as something else. So they're trying to go back.
Doc, you've just spurred just a giant brainstorm here because a friend of mine told me, because of cable prices being so expensive, he says, well, I just disconnected from that. I do Netflix and I do Hulu. And then I just get over the air
TV
by putting some kind of paper clip in the deal in the back. What is this? What do you do?
You can get over the air digital TV very easily. Yeah,
just get a box, right? There's a digital converter that you hook up to your antenna,
I don't have an antenna anymore.
Except your TV will support digital over the air input.
Really?
It will.
And it's free.
It's free. Okay. It's free.
You have to get the box, though. This is the box that they were giving away for free, right, Doc? You get the coupon?
Yeah, but you could do it with, you just hang rabbit ears out the window.
Oh, that's right. So with the new TVs, you don't even need the box, right?
You don't need the box because they're already digital.
That's right.
I'm all
right.
over this, Doc, because I'm telling you, the only reason I haven't gone, total atomic, in other words, unplugging cable, going network, going Netflix and the other one, is I want local news.
Yeah.
I can get local news, I'll unplug that bad boy this afternoon.
You can.
So you don't watch any sports on your TV?
No.
So what you've got to do?
Listen to radio.
What you've got to do to get the digital signal is that you need a good signal to noise, and so you simply get an antenna with an amplifier.
Signal to noise.
So you get like a 90 dB amplifier.
Right.
And so you just get an amplified signal. That's all you need.
Sheesh.
Well,
that's all he'll
probably need that because he is out in the hinterlands up there in.
I'm in the northern territories.
He's above the Arctic Circle in Urbana, right?
Pretty close, man.
But you could just put the antenna up in your attic, and then you just get an amplifier. You'll get enough signal. You can play around with it.
What are you doing next weekend after
Chuck does? Yeah, really. Can you bring your tinfoil helmet and everything?
Bring the whole thing. A lot of people are listening right now. Want to do this? Local channels.
And then what you do? You see your TV has an antenna input,
right?
And then it's got a sort of a cable input. So if you're going to use, say it would be like a DVD, it would be like a DVD input.
Right.
So if you're using Netflix with your DVD player, is that how you're getting internet access? How do you get internet? How do you get Netflix at your house through your DVD?
No. I'll keep. You heard the triple play. I'll keep the computer hookup.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's how I'll get my Netflix and all that kind of mm-hmm. stuff. But I don't need.
So, but how much of a savings?
How do you get the internet into your TV? Do you just plug your?
It's Wi-Fi.
Oh, your internet's Wi-Fi. Right. Oh, you've got a very fancy.
No, well, I worked for you forever.
Do you get your cable from the same place you get your internet?
Yes,
and all that?
Yes.
So, will you actually save any money by bailing out on how much?
$60-$70.
So all you'll do is you'll just change the input. Just change the input to antenna. And then you'll have an antenna with an amplifier. You'll get over the air
and
stuff.
Just disconnect the cable part.
And you'll just disconnect the cable part. Yeah,
Hey, what's the look, Jimmy?
I'm just saying it's so simple. It's not. I'm just saying, hey, look, he's
okay, man.
But you won't be able You won't be able to get pure cable plays like Discovery Channel. That'll be gone. CNN will be gone.
Masson's gone. Stuff like that.
You know, Fox News will be gone.
Boy, got silent here. I love everybody now. Come on. I love everybody. Yes, I do. Well, Doc, that was beautiful.
So, allow me to ask. So, once David gets rid of that, and we've been talking about Google TV and Apple TV, and you get a dongle for that, right?
Yeah.
So, would that – I said the word dongle, and he lit up.
So the thing is you can get content other than over the air stuff from Google TV or Apple TV. So they have contracts for content you can get through them. But if you just want the over the air stuff, the way to do it is with the antenna.
Because
that's
like your local news. That's like
Netflix
your local
and Hulu.
What do you get off of Hulu? I've had so many people.
TV shows, the whole thing.
I've heard so many frustrated with Hulu.
I'm not frustrated at all.
No kidding.
No, I'm having a great time. As a matter of fact, I spend so much time on Netflix and Hulu, I'm going, why am I bothering with cable?
Yeah.
Why? Because I want to see the news.
Yeah.
I don't care about that. I don't care about the cable.
I'd miss baseball if I didn't have a cable.
Right. Well, you get radio.
The thing is, with Netflix,
Word pictures.
The thing I like about Netflix, if you want to watch a movie, you just watch it and it starts right now. You don't have to have a schedule like you do with regular cable. You got to look up and you turn on, you get the movie, it's right in the middle of the movie.
You got everything on Netflix. Mm-hmm. Everything.
I know. I use it for stuff. Do I look like I'm a caveman?
It's every
over
movie
here?
That's more than 4 years old.
Exactly. Walk towards the light.
Walk to the light, David. Walk to the light. Yeah.
All right, Doc. Listen, thank you for that information.
We're here to help.
Okay. I'll take it to heart.
You know, this is a health program.
Exactly.
We teach people to fish here.
And good luck with that drone.
Okay. Well, I'm checking this out a little bit. I'm going to have to be flying my drone in disguise. You know,
Put a mustache on it. What's the range of your drone miles wise? Is it miles?
No, I can only go up to 1,000 feet with it, I can get 1,200 feet. My controller will control it out to 1,200 feet.
That's it.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about height. I'm talking about distance.
It's 1,200 feet from the controller.
It's 1,200 feet from the controller, either out horizontally or straight up.
Oh, okay.
So then you go like 50 feet out and 1,150 up.
How does Amazon plan on delivering packages
It's under probably GPS control. So they don't see. And the reason that mine's limited to 1,000 feet, it's that I've got a very low power transmitter that meets the FCC requirements. Now, if I go in there and just goose it up.
No, not you, Doc.
Goose it up.
Because I would never violate an FCC standard here. Never.
Okay.
But the people that are flying their drones, say at 2,000-3,000 feet, have goosed up their transmitter.
I've never noticed it before. There's a lightning bolt in this thing. What happened here? I didn't know. Bangs always covered it.
That's right.
So I forgot the question.
That's all right,
buddy. I'm old.
I'm leaving now. Bye-bye.
Actually, we're all leaving now. That's it for this week. Thanks for listening to Tech Talk Radio here on Federal News Radio. We'll see you next week.
This page
paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT-FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
Press conference.